of February 14th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 42, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in Vancouver, Canada, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're not really in Vancouver, are you?
No, not really. I wish I were, though.
Well, before we get started today, I guess I should start with a programming note. Next week, I'm going to be traveling and we won't be able to have a podcast. However, sorry about that, guys.
It's our first one in like a year that we've missed.
That's true. And I'm just hoping that absolutely nothing happens in the entertainment world for the next, 14 days.
I'm sure nothing will.
Well, that is a good time to head on over to iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, where you can download all of our back episodes and catch up on all of the wonderful banter that you've missed. In fact, you should subscribe and even rate and review the podcast there.
Hey, whenever people give me feedback, it's always how much they like our banter. So there you go.
Well, there you have it. And of course, every week we don't start off with banter, but we do start off with entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz telling us how we fared at the North American box office.
That's exactly right. And it was Valentine's Day weekend, and shockingly, the number one movie at the box office was Valentine's Day at $52 million. It stars Taylor Swift, of course, and a couple other Hollywood stars. At number two was Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief, a Harry Jackson wannabe cleverly tying into the Olympic Games that are taking place in Vancouver
right now. Harry Potter wannabe.
Yes.
Harry Jackson.
And it grossed $31 million, which is a not bad debut. We'll see how it does worldwide. Maybe it is a franchise. Number three is The Wolfman, starring Benicio del Toro, which grossed $30 million despite sitting on the shelf for almost 2 years and being an indifferent film that almost every critic despised, yet somehow it still grossed $30 million. And number four was Karen's favorite film of the year, Avatar, which grossed $22 million its ninth week at the box office. It's at $660 million in the U.S., $1.26 billion overseas.
No, that can't be true. It's got to be $2.26 billion.
$2.26 billion worldwide as it continues to just steamroller over every other movie in history. And at number five was Dear John, the horrible romantic drama starring Channing Tatum that collapsed 50% despite being a romantic drama out in theaters during Valentine's Day weekend. It's grossed $53 million total, so it's a very profitable film. It only cost $25 million to make. Six through 10 were all basically underperforming flops. Tooth Fairy, From Paris with Love, Edge of Darkness, When in Rome. And the only movie really to capitalize on the Oscar nominations, if you don't count Avatar, is Crazy Heart, the Jeff Bridges film that has expanded to 1,000 screens. It grossed $4 million this weekend, $16 million total, so it's past the Hurt Locker. And it cost $7 million to make and was picked up for a dime by Fox Searchlight. So it is capitalized on its Oscar nomination and is the Cinderella story of the moment for the Oscars. Down at number 12 is The Blind Side, which is still chugging along, $245 million to date. And on 120 screens, a Hindi film called My Name is Khan, which has a crazy plot involving Asperger's syndrome, 9/11, and Barack Obama. And that grossed a pretty strong $1.86 million on just 120 screens. You'd think it was a Christian evangelist film playing to youth groups. But no, it's not. It's a Hindi film, and it's doing pretty well.
It's actually a Bollywood movie, and it does star one of probably the biggest movie star in the world, Shah Rukh Khan, who caused a little bit of a controversy around this film because he's also an owner of an Indian Premier League cricket team. I know this sounds probably just as absurd as the movie's plot, but he is one of the owners of these cricket teams in India. And during their draft, he was shocked that no Pakistani players were selected when the Pakistanis are some of the best cricket players in the world. And so he said something about that publicly, and some of the politicians in India caused this big ruckus, some of the right-wing politicians saying, how dare he, he's unpatriotic. And this all stems from the Mumbai bombing from, I think it was November 26, 2008. And, everybody's against Pakistan now because that bombing was planned in Pakistan. And so he never apologized. And in India, there were tons of protests and theater owners were afraid to show the movie at first. At least some of them were. And it still wound up being a huge hit in India. And it's 2 hours and 25 minutes long.
Which is brisk by Bollywood standards.
Yes. So, but for it to make $1.86 million in North America on only 120 screens, that's a $15,000 screen average. That's pretty good.
people are definitely, you know, chomping at the bit to see it, I guess.
Well, you know what it's about, right?
To a degree.
Well, Shah Rukh Khan plays this character who has Asperger's syndrome, which is a high-functioning form of...
autism.
Yes, autism. And he is going through LAX, Los Angeles.
He's going through an airport security system, and they think he's acting strange when it's simply the natural result of having Asperger's syndrome. And so they pull him aside and question him. And
right, correct. And then, of course, the main character wants to go and meet Barack Obama to... I don't exactly know why he wants to meet Barack Obama, but he's a Muslim. Shah Rukh Khan is a Muslim, and a lot of people feel that that's why he's being singled out here.
I saw Valentine's Day.
So did I. I saw Valentine's Day and Percy Jackson, and I couldn't bring myself to see The Wolfman. What did you think of Valentine's Day?
I thought it was sweet. It's not a very good movie, but, you know, it was what it was. Utterly forgettable. I thought Ashton Kutcher and Jennifer Garner did a fantastic job. And I thought that Taylor Swift was the funniest thing in the movie.
She was funny. It was not a... I thought it was an awful movie, but she was game and she did good and she got to kiss Taylor Lautner, so she had fun. Taylor Lautner had a funny line. She told him to put on the jersey she got him for Valentine's Day, and he was like, "Oh, I'm embarrassed to take my shirt off in public."
Yeah, I burst out laughing
because I thought it was a joke about.
Did you stay for the credits?
No, I did. I ran out of theater.
The
I really hated.
Best part of the whole movie was the credits.
Oh, what happened?
Well, it plays all the outtakes.
Oh, hilarious outtakes! The whole movie was an outtake.
No, I know, but imagine how funny the real outtakes were. But there was a scene when Julia Roberts is in the limo at the very end of the movie, and the driver says to her as she passes by the hotel that some pretty woman says, "Hey, we're passing Rodeo Drive. Have you ever been here?" And she said, "No, I don't think I have." Big mistake. Huge mistake. And that whatever the line is from Pretty Woman, oh my god, my theater just roared with laughter.
Well, apparently she like filmed her part in like a day and a half, and Gary Marshall got
almost every role is geared so that you could do it. I mean, she has like three scenes, so it's all arranged so that people can get in and out in a week or a week and a half, 2 weeks at the most, and be done. So that's how they had 15-20 stars in it.
Right, and Gary Marshall said in some interviews he was doing for Valentine's Day that the way he casts his movies is he figures out who's going to be like having a kid or want to stay in town, and he's going to shoot in Los Angeles because, you know, that's pretty much, you know, you're guaranteed to get a few movie stars that want to stay in town. And so that's how he goes about casting his movie.
That's smart.
Yeah, not a bad idea.
I thought there were too many stars in this. You couldn't really get to know any of them, but it was a bad
movie. I mean, yeah. I thought each story was more insipid than the last. I did think that I thought Julia Roberts was going to be a lesbian, but it turned out I knew there'd be some gay element because it just felt like that kind of film where they would do something.
Oh my God, don't give it away. It's such a twist. My entire theater went, oh!
Well, I saw it with teenage girls, and the funny thing was you're watching the movie, and there's a character who turns out to be married. You know, big shocker. And he says, "Oh, I'm going to the airport now." And instead we see him pulling to his home and going to his family. And all the teenage girls literally went, "Oh," like it was all new to them. Oh my God, he's married.
I saw it immediately. Like I totally saw it coming. I'm like, oh, he's totally married.
At least it was new to them. So did anybody see Percy Jackson in the Olympians?
Yeah, you did.
That's right.
I saw your Twitter that you liked it.
No, not at all. I gave it 1 star out of 4. I didn't like it. It was bad. It looked like an episode of Xena. I do like the kid, the lead. He's not good in the movie as such because it's a bad film, but Logan Lerman is from a TV show called Jack and Bobby, which I quite liked.
Loved that show.
Yeah, I did too. And the other lead actor, the other kid in that show is in The Deep End, the ABC legal drama, which is flopping. So at least Logan had a success with this movie, but not a good film.
Well, if you take the top 4 movies, or actually just the top 3 movies at this week's box office, they made over $110 million. The box office is on fire, and that's even without Avatar. It's like $132 million with Avatar.
Yeah, it set a record for the Valentine's weekend, didn't it?
I'm not sure. I didn't.
Let's move on.
Well, I guess we can move on to, we were talking about movie stars in Valentine's Day. We can talk about movie stars nominated for Oscars who seem to be bickering. And if they're not bickering, at least the people representing them or rooting for them to win an Oscar are, and that is Sandra Bullock for The Blind Side and Meryl Streep for Julie and Julia, and both are nominated for Best Actress. Sandra Bullock has won the Golden Globe, she won the SAG Award, she was nominated for an Oscar, of course, and she won some award over the weekend.
The Riviera Award.
Right, at the Santa Barbara Film Festival. And, of course, Meryl Streep was nominated because apparently she can be nominated just for reading the phone book. But
Rightfully so.
Rightfully, yeah, she's fantastic. And there was an interesting article in the Daily Beast titled Oscar Diva Smackdown. And I guess it's about how their camps are kind of doing battle with one another in public, and how
it seemed to briefly be about that,
right? And really, it's about how these actors and actresses campaign for these awards,
and the storyline, the best storyline gets the Oscar, essentially,
right? Kind of Jamie Foxx playing Ray Charles, his hero.
Yeah, that's Jeff Bridges' year this year, and let's face it, the whole reason why Julia Roberts got an Oscar for a very underwhelming performance was because people felt it was her year. Halle Berry, the only reason why she got it was because she got naked and it was her year.
I actually liked Julia Roberts and Erin Brockovich, and I think one big reason she won was because of the DVD extras. People were talking about that because the DVD had all these extra scenes where she had really great meaty moments, and a lot of people watched them and were talking about them, and it added to the allure of her performance. But what I didn't like about this piece
was the allure of her performance.
I thought she was really good. Yeah.
You
get to see the outtakes and they're really good too, then you're talking about a good performance. Some people's performances are shaped in the editing room. Other people give you a ton of good stuff to work with. And that was the case with Julia Roberts. But what I didn't like about the article was the whole, they're catfight, diva smackdown, they're bickering. It's like, no. You know, Sandra Bullock's campaigning hard to get her award, as she wants to and is the right to. Meryl Streep is, as always, remaining above the fray. She doesn't want to campaign for the awards, just like, you know, whatever. She just wants the work to speak for itself. And they did it. They're at each other's throats. I found very tiresome.
Right, and I guess during the SAG Awards, Sandra Bullock, upon winning, kissed Meryl Streep.
They tied.
Oh, they tied. So
that's why they kissed.
That's why they kissed. And everybody is saying, that was such a calculated move on Sandra Bullock's part as a way to advance the narrative on her march to the Oscar.
That's ridiculous.
Exactly.
Again, though, it was really only the first page of this article that was really about a diva smackdown. The rest of it was really about the idea of campaigning for an award and, you know, the best narrative wins. And that, to me, was much more interesting.
And do you think Sandra has the best narrative?
I do.
I think this year she absolutely does, especially given the fact that when you think about it, for the proposal of a role that Julia Roberts turned down because it was not going to pay her enough, Sandra Bullock steps in, I believe, at half the price of Julia Roberts, turns that movie into a huge hit, and then in the same year produces and stars in The Blind Side, a movie that everybody laughed at.
I don't think she produced it. Did she produce it? She produced All About Steve, that terrible movie.
Okay, so maybe she didn't produce it, but at the bottom line is she starred in it, and everybody laughed at her, saying, it's a pure Oscar grab. And in the end, it worked.
And I think that Julia Roberts actually also turned down The Blind Side.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's true. You're right, actually. Yeah, I remember that now. So I think they want to reward somebody who is taking less money and making a mint for Hollywood. Maybe that will actually make Tom Cruise an Oscar nominee next year.
Yes, segue into that.
Yes, that was my poor segue into the fact that Tom Cruise is reuniting with Paramount for a fourth edition of Mission Impossible. I guess it would be Mission Impossible 4. So the Mission Impossible franchise isn't being rebooted without Tom Cruise. However, as Claudia Eller pointed out in the Los Angeles Times, Mr. Cruise will not be getting his $25 million salary. He will be getting a $20 million salary instead, which...
That's rough.
Poor guy, yeah. The bigger deal is the fact that he will not get any part of first dollar gross, which was his right up until, I guess, this film, and the right of certain movie stars like Harrison Ford or Mel Gibson or Denzel Washington. And Paramount basically said, no way. And, of course, you remember back in 2006, after Mission Impossible 3, Sumner Redstone, the head of Viacom, which owns Paramount, was so livid with Tom Cruise because of his preaching or proselytizing for Scientology and jumping on the couch with Oprah Winfrey that he said, look, you cost us $150 million. He took his production company and Paula Wagner, his partner, and threw them both off the lot. And now they're, I guess, back together and bosom buddies as he's going to march off and do Mission Impossible 4.
Well, not so bosom, but he's not getting first dollar gross, which frankly has always made the most sense to me as a way to pay an actor of that caliber. Yeah. Because you do have to understand that people come to a Tom Cruise movie. People will go to a Jim Carrey comedy, that they are definitely part of the draw. And that's how they essentially deserve their $20 million, you know, up front. But if you can't afford to pay them up front, and it does seem rather astronomical, you pay them on the back end. That's always made much more sense to me.
Ah, but it's not the back end, and that's the problem. And here's an example of that. Mission Impossible 3 made $400 million worldwide, and DVD revenue of $200 million, and an additional $100 million for television rights and television airings. Now, with all of that combined, the studio barely broke even, and that's because Cruise was guaranteed 22.5% of the studio gross receipts, not the net receipts, not after they've broken even and made their money. And he walked off with $80 million, leaving Paramount with, as Claudia Eller points, nothing to gain from its $180 million investment in Mission Impossible 3. So that's...
So does he get a percentage of the net then?
Yes, he does. He does get a percentage of the net. But of
Which
course,
means he'll never see it.
Yeah, the old joke about Paramount executives that Art Buchwald wrote after he won his Coming to America lawsuit back in the 80s was, why can't the Paramount executives play tennis?
Why?
They can't find the nets.
I'm surprised Tom Cruise agreed to that.
Well, is this the new normal, or is this simply Tom Cruise trying to rehabilitate himself at the box office?
I think it's both. I think that you're going to see movie stars not getting this first dollar gross deals in the future, especially if Tom Cruise isn't getting it. And I think, frankly, he really does need a huge hit movie to raise his stature again in Hollywood. And there's nothing like another Mission Impossible film. Frankly, he should have picked another big action film to do it rather than rehashing something that we've all seen before.
And I've probably all decided that we're tired of.
Correct.
Well, it's his only franchise, and he hasn't done it well yet. But I don't get it. Either he's bargaining from a position of strength, or he's not. I mean, Will Smith isn't going to take this deal. Tom Cruise is the one who needs help, not Will Smith. Not, you know, name five other big stars. Not George Clooney. Not whoever. You know, Tom Cruise is the one who needs help. Therefore, he's taking this deal. Why do you say everybody else will not follow suit?
Because there's precedent. Once there's precedent with a big A-list star like Tom Cruise not taking it, then...
That's what we're saying. He's not a big A-list star right now. He's got a bad, damaged reputation. He's got a series of underperforming movies. Valkyrie made $200 million worldwide. Alliance for Lambs made $60 million worldwide. Collateral made $200 million worldwide. I mean, these are movies that you shouldn't be getting $60, $80 million for, so...
Yeah, but still, the Mission Impossible franchise made $1.4 billion for Paramount so far.
Yeah, I agree. They've established something that can be pointed to and said, well, we did not give it to Tom Cruise. We're not going to give it to you. And the only real argument that an agent has, except for giving a whole rundown of their client's movies that have made more than Tom Cruise's, which is certainly an option, is to say something like, yeah, but Tom Cruise is trying to rehabilitate his career. And it's like, okay, well, you know, prove it.
Well, and they didn't give it to Julia Roberts. And Julie Roberts walked, and Sandra Bullock played those roles and made a mint for the studio and was nominated for an Academy Award. So,
but Sandra got a big chunk of the back end on The Blind Side and made tons of money.
Back end, not first dollar gross.
Yes, but back end, not net. She didn't get net. She got gross.
Back end is gross or net. I don't differentiate.
Yeah, she got back end.
Back end is back end.
Nobody gets net. Net is meaningless. She got a chunk of the money that they grossed at the box office.
I'd like to see the proof of that.
There was a huge article. I'll look for it while we talk.
Well, I was going to say J.J. Abrams got the same as Claudia Eller says, take it or leave it deal, where he was basically told, you know, you're not going to be paid your quote and there's no first dollar gross. And even though your star is on the rise, too bad.
J.J. Abrams?
J.J. Abrams.
Wow.
What are you talking about? He's not a box office power yet. He is now.
Yes, he is.
Now they did Star Trek, but he wasn't before that.
Well, when was this deal made?
He's talking about the deal for Star Trek, aren't you?
No, I'm talking about the deal for Mission Impossible 4. He's going to be one of the producers.
Mission Impossible 4. Yeah, I don't think J.J. Abrams is a guaranteed, you know, box office powerhouse yet.
I think he is more so than Tom Cruise. He doesn't pass the mom test, but he passes the geek test. And my mom is not going to want to see Mission Impossible 4 anyway. Speaking about geeks, let's move on to the 3D brouhaha that you posted.
Well, actually, before we get to that, my question was going to be, does your mom want to see Alice in Wonderland, which is the Tim Burton movie, which is going to be released...
Not in a million years.
Really?
Really?
No.
Well,
it's too Tim Burton-y for her.
Well, she's only going to have 12 weeks rather than the usual 16 weeks to do so, because Disney has thrown down the gauntlet, as the LA Times, the Hollywood Reporter, and countless other outlets have said. They have decided, the studio that is, that they are going to release Alice in Wonderland on DVD just 3 months after its appearance in theaters. So that release window, which is about 4 months, 8 days, roughly, in 2009, which is also, by the way, stayed steady since about 2005, they're going to shorten it by a good 30 days, a good 4 weeks. And so, you know, this has supposedly angered movie theater owners, or that's at least the story. We're about to post a story on Celluloid Junkie about this issue, because it's something that has been an issue now for the past several months and past year or two. And it's really heated up because of Bob Iger, who has publicly said he would like to release films in the theater on video on demand and on DVD all at the same time to take advantage of his marketing dollars.
Which is moronic.
Well, what the exhibitors are saying, and what none of these articles pointed out, or at least they didn't do it well, is that the exhibitors are actually working with the studios to figure out which pictures the release window should be shortened on, so that they can do it together rather than having it sprung on them by a studio. And they're going to pick selectively. So one of the selective picks was Alice in Wonderland.
Well, that's a shortened window, though, but 12 weeks is a ton of time. Avatar has grossed in 9 weeks, $2.2 billion. You don't need a lot. You don't need 6 months anymore.
12 weeks is about average
right.
in the theater now anyway.
Right. 12 weeks, they're gone anyway. Exactly. I mean, unless it's a small film that has legs like 500 Days of Summer or The Blind Side, most movies are dramatically done by the 12th week. They're out of theaters. They're done. They're not grossing anything more anyway.
Well, Patrick Goldstein in the Los Angeles Times basically said in his column about the issue, look, it depends on the movie. You know, you can't really answer the question as to whether a shorter release window cuts into the theatrical box office because, you know, in some cases, your audience was never going to show up in the first place. And in others, like this one, he writes, Disney's calculation with Alice is that the film has such a huge contingent of diehard loyalists, Johnny Depp fans, Tim Burton fans, and parents eager to share a family-friendly film with their kids, that its core fan base won't be willing to put off seeing the film, which is true, especially if you want to see it in 3D. And 12 weeks out, you're not going to have those 3D screens anymore. It's not like, you know, Avatar, where everybody just cleared a wide berth for Avatar for at least 4 to 8 weeks so that Avatar could have those screens.
Right, and that's our point. It's like, and guess what, though? If we weren't talking about the 3D, if we were just talking about keeping it in the theater, if come week 11, Alice in Wonderland was grossing over $20 million a week, they would delay the release of the DVD. You know, there would be no, if it was still making money hand over fist in the theater, you just delay it. It's no big deal.
Right. I mean, the Disney executive said that they wanted to avoid the DVD sales drop-off, which occurs during the summer. As well, they wanted to avoid the World Cup.
Well, that's a European theatrical release. They wanted to get it out of theaters in Europe before World Cup jumped in, because nobody goes to the movies during World Cup in June. So they know that in Europe, they've got a window that ends come June. You don't want to put any movies out in June in Europe because nobody's going.
No,
so
they wanted to put the
theatrical thing.
They wanted to put the DVD out before.
Yeah, they wanted to get it out of theaters. They know they have to have its box office run before World Cup, because there's no point in leaving a movie in the theaters in June.
Right, but nobody's buying DVDs either, is what they're saying.
Nobody does anything in Europe except watch World Cup.
Ever. That's all they ever do in Europe.
Well, all right, and on that note.
Well, the
3D thing is a big problem, though. How many years is it going to take, Sperling, before we have enough 3D screens? We've got Avatar, which could probably have stayed in theaters longer and kept making money, but it's getting big-footed by Alice. We've got the Harry Potter. We've got all these movies with, you know, we've got a clash of scheduling between, what is the movie? It's a Clash of the Titans and How to Train Your Dragon. Everybody's angry at everyone else because there are only so many 3D screens. How many years is it going to take before we have enough theaters that are 3D capable that we're not going to have to, theaters aren't going to have to pick and choose which movie to show?
Well, in North America, we have about 3,500 screens that are 3D capable. Now, the problem is, of course, as a film progresses through its run, you go from the big screen where you have 3D to maybe a smaller medium-sized screen, which may not have 3D. And that's part of the problem, is that this 3D technology requires a digital cinema server and a digital projector, which costs a fortune and not every auditorium is equipped with all of the technology to project such films in 3D. So that being said, and I reported on this on Celluloid Junkie this week, JP Morgan apparently is about to announce that they have raised $700 million for digital cinema implementation partners, which is a group that was put together by Regal Entertainment, AMC Theaters, and Cinemark to roll out digital cinema in those three circuits. So once they have that $700 million, which should be in the first part of this year, then the rollout will begin in earnest for those three circuits, which account for actually 40% of the screens in North America. So figure roughly 2 to 3 years after they get their money, which should be coming shortly.
I saw the article that said, oh, Katzenberg was angry about Clash of the Titans coming out in 3D. And I thought, great, somebody who wants to protect the integrity of 3D is angry that this 2D movie is passing itself off as a 3D film and charging top dollar when it's not really designed for that purpose. But no, he was just angry because it was Bigfoot in his own film. But you have Clash of the Titans and Harry Potter, the last two Harry Potters coming out in 3D. Don't you think? And now the next Spider-Man is going to be in 3D. At least that's designed to be in 3D. But really, when every movie's in 3D, doesn't that stop being special? I'm not going to want to pay an extra $3-4 for every darn movie.
Right, but
can we just pause for a second and laugh that you thought that Katzenberg had integrity?
Well, he says he's an animation buff, and I thought, you know, if
the
like
animation buff, I don't know if we could call him a buff.
Yeah, one of the driving forces in Disney's animation renaissance.
Doesn't mean he's a buff.
He's more like a fan, not a buff.
But I mean, I don't pay extra for color or sound, and I'm tired, frankly, of paying extra for 3D.
Yes, but you did pay extra for sound in 1939 when it was brand spanking new.
I don't think he was around in 1939.
No, I'm just saying, you know.
You ain't heard nothing yet. I still remember those glory days of the Nickelodeon.
Well, you know, Katzenberg actually has a right to be pissed because Clash of the Titans was put onto the release schedule as a 2D film and How to Train Your Dragon was slotted in with the intention that it would replace Alice in Wonderland, but there's not enough time for How to Train Your Dragon to play. It's 2 weeks. And I talked
Nothing.
To Yeah, I mean, I talked to one exhibitor last week that said come April, he very well may be juggling 5 3D films. Anything that's left over from Avatar, which, you know, at that point you could probably split the screen. How to Train Your Dragon, Alice in Wonderland, Clash of the Titans, and I guess Kenny Chesney, a country music star, has a 3D concert film coming out. So that's 5 different films.
Why do I need to see that in 3D? How is this going to work?
It's a nightmare.
It's a nightmare. That's exactly the problem. Now,
there's enough screens for one movie. Maybe two.
And last year, a 3D film stayed on a 3D screen on average between 3 and 4 weeks. This year, if you look at the release patterns, that is going to shrink to 1.7 weeks.
Wow. And when it's actually a 3D movie like How to Train Your Dragon, I want to see it in 3D. Clash of the Titans, I'm going to specifically go see in 2D. But I'm not going to go see How to Train Your Dragon in 2D when I know it was designed and meant to be seen in 3D. So when it's gone after 2 weeks and is on 2D, I'm not going to see it.
Are you going to see Spider-Man in 3D, which is going to be released?
Yeah, designed in 3D. I will, but I'll be annoyed that I'm being charged extra for it.
Well, the studios are looking to replace any revenue they're losing on DVD sales, which they're losing a ton of money on DVD sales.
Losing a ton of money. They're making $16 to $18 billion a year on DVD sales and rentals. They're making more on DVD sales than they are in theaters. And 25, 30 years ago, they were making nothing on home video sales. So they are not losing money. They're making a ton of money. They're simply not grossing as ridiculous hand over fist amount of money as they were 2 or 3 years ago when DVDs were first introduced. $18 billion a year is not losing money. They are making a ton of money on DVDs.
Now, let me ask you this. You said 20 years ago they weren't making anything?
30 years, whatever. I'm talking about before VCRs.
Okay, well, here's the question. Before VCRs and before DVDs, what was the average budget of a film?
I don't care. Movies make more today than they did then. They make more worldwide. They didn't have overseas as much. They make far more money overseas than they ever did before. They still haven't even tapped China and India. They make far more money. They make money on DVD that didn't exist before. They have cable channels paying money for movies that didn't exist 30 years ago. HBO, Showtime, FX, you name it. There's 10 million more revenue streams that they have today than they never did before. When you add it up, movies are far more profitable than they ever were before. It doesn't matter that they cost twice as much to make. They're big babies. They're making tons of money. And the reason they don't publish how much money they make on DVDs is because they're afraid stars will demand more money up front because they know they're making money hand over fist.
Michael, you seem a little hostile today.
Well, they're it's every time we repeat the lie that they're losing money on DVDs is absurd.
They're not losing money on DVDs.
They're making tons of money.
They're not making as much money as they used to.
And of course not. It was a brand new item.
And
but the story is, huh?
But what my point is that they actually budget these movies at $180 million, not because they think they're going to make $360 million, which is how much they'd have to make for a film that costs $180 million to even break even. They'd have to make twice that because, of course, the movie theaters keep some money and they have to market the film. They actually look at, well, how much money can we make theatrically and in home video?
Of course they do.
So the point is that the movies that cost $150, $180 million to make, if they can't make their money back in ancillary markets, be it television or DVD or, you know, anywhere, home video, then they're going to have to start lowering the budgets, which they did with Mission Impossible 4. Instead of $180 million, they're spending $150. So you're beginning to see that effect is what I'm saying.
Movie budgets get bloated for a little while, then they come back down, then they get bloated, then they come back down. It's a cyclical thing that's been happening since the beginning of time.
Can we talk about TV now?
Well, TV is where you watch your DVDs. So technically, we have
that
been talking
a segue.
About
and TV is where we watch the Olympics opening ceremonies, which unfortunately had to follow the Chinese, the greatest opening ceremonies in the history of opening ceremonies. What did you think, Karen?
I thought it was like a school play. I thought it was terrible.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Really? I thought it wasn't that bad. I didn't watch the whole thing. I didn't watch the parade or the hour-long tribute to the Native Americans. But I thought Katie Lang sounded great. I thought the kid on the trapeze, on the aerial thing, flying around was pretty appealing. And
I thought that he was like the janitor who they just kind of plucked. I mean, he was wearing like jeans and a sweatshirt. What was that?
It's the and then when the fourth piece of the flame torch didn't open up, I thought that was so Canadian.
That was the best part of the whole thing.
It was so Canadian. So have you started watching the games? Are you excited?
I'm having the best time watching these. I'm so obsessed with the Olympics. I start to really care about things that I never would care about. I've become obsessed with mogul skiing and speed skating and
and you know, curling. I can't wait for curling.
That I don't watch curling.
Oh, I know how to use a broom. Everybody can think of being a curler.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's like bowling on ice.
That's a good point. And I have them all like pushed to my phone so I find out like 2 hours ahead of time who wins. And it really takes away the pressure because I get really concerned, you know?
Well, last night I was watching the Paris figure skating, and I watched this Canadian team that I guess in 2006, one of them accidentally cut the other person's face with their skate, which, you know, let's face it, it's not a laughing matter. It's fairly serious. They were, you know, kind of out of the Olympics for that year, and they did their routine. What is so funny?
I don't know. Go on.
So they did their routine. One of them fell, and they wound up in second place. And I just thought, how is this a sport again where, like, you can actually really screw up and still somehow wind up in second place ahead of those people who didn't fall down?
We might have had a higher complexity value, a higher start value.
Yeah, I know that, but I just found it very ironic that the Olympics happens to be taking place in Canada and the people who fell down were Canadian and wound up in second place.
Oh, correct. Yeah, probably. But, you know, it's not a sport. It's a competition. Let's be real.
They should have a reality show.
They did. It was called Skating with the Stars.
Oh, yeah. Completely forgot about that. Was it on MTV?
Speaking of, no, it wasn't. But that's a good segue.
We're like rewarding each other for our good segues today.
I know. That's good, right? It means we're moving along steadily.
Well, I had to move along. You were laughing at people getting their face slashed by ice skates.
There's just something about it.
That's always funny.
For some reason, I found just hysterical.
That's always funny.
Cut
Come
that
on.
Out. But okay, so for the first time in 28 years, MTV has changed its iconic logo, which when I first looked at this, I was like, okay, well, whatever. It's a big deal, big whoop. But then I looked at it and I really saw what they'd done. And they've cut off the bottom, so it no longer says music television. And they've widened the sticks on the M so that they can now plash the face of their reality stars, like Snooki or Sookie, whatever her name is, from Jersey Shore. The rest of the article goes on to kind of talk about how the MTV brand has changed. And that to me was really the most interesting part, is because although we've been joking around for years, all of us, that MTV doesn't play music videos anymore, it's not even about music anymore. I mean, it should be like RTV for reality television.
Well, how do you like the new logo? Do you think it's good or bad, or is it bland, or does it work?
You know, at first it looked like it was, I realized something was missing. It was only when I saw them side by side that I realized it was because they had essentially just cut off the bottom of the M. So it almost looked like somebody without their pants on. There's something really weird about it.
I can't believe you just made that analogy. But okay, let's move on.
But no, but one last thing before we move on is that according to Tina Ekaros, MTV's exec VP marketing, she says that MTV is currently experimenting with the idea of creating a tagline.
Really?
Now, as somebody who has written copy for MTV websites, that would be me, I am so waiting for this call.
Do you have any ideas?
I'm kind of mulling them around in my head, but...
It now stands for music, not so much television.
MTV, yeah, we suck.
How about, I don't really need my MTV so much anymore.
Well, if you think something's missing on MTV's logo... And you're a little confused, just be glad you're not watching Lost, because the show gets more and more complicated with every day. I have friends who are watching...
Wait a second. Are you going to start talking about Lost? Because I've recorded the first two episodes of this season, and I have not watched them yet. So I will not be part of that live plus seven.
Sperling,
you have to watch Lost in real time.
I don't know what, why.
The world does not wait for people who TiVo Lost. That's the one show that you must watch in real time.
Wow. I think we just
it
found
used to
our
be
title.
24. Now you can get away with it. It used to be you would see in the paper the next day like recaps of 24 and who'd been executed and tortured. And now I can get away with I haven't watched last week's 24. It doesn't matter. But
yeah,
but
no one's watching
with
it.
Lost, you're in trouble if you're not staying on top of it. So what I found amusing was I found on Media
Freak. Sperling, are you gonna have to mute yourselves? Should we
yeah,
tell
we'll,
our-
we'll let them know when to. On MediaWeek.com they had a recap.
Wait a second, we should say that we're gonna have a spoiler alert, and so
that's what I'm telling them right now.
Okay, sorry.
So what I found amusing was that I found a recap in MediaWeek.com and in their blog, MediaFreakBlog.com, and it ran down some of the stuff that people learned in the first two new episodes of the season. So if you haven't listened or watched the first two episodes of the season yet and you plan to, mute yourselves for the next 60 seconds, and that includes you, Sperling, while I run down some of the things that we've learned in the first two episodes. Are you ready, Sperling?
Okay, I'm going to take my headphones off and mute myself, so I'll be back in 60 seconds.
Okay,
go. So in the 2004 plotline, where the plane lands at LAX, Claire finds out that the adoption of her child is not an option because the couple who were going to do it has split up. Could this allude to the warning that Claire was given not to give up her child? In 2004, Ethan Goodspeed, who is another and son of the 70s other leader Horace, is the attending doctor on Claire when she is rushed to the hospital in labor. As we know from season one, Charlie kills Ethan on the 2004 plane crash island reality because there's plane crash island reality and plane landing reality. Also, right. Ethan is the OB administering the hypodermic needles to Claire on the island after she's taken. We can only guess he was injecting her with. Number three, the substance Dogen makes for Saeed reincarnate, who is the reincarnation of Saeed in the 2007 reality. Dogen tells Jack that he must administer the pill to Saeed reincarnate. It's a tiny green one, which Dogen later says contains, quote, poison. The drug is used to fight off the infection, which creates a darkness in the infected, which is part of being what Dogen calls claimed.
I read this too when it first came out, and I was like, wait, what? Does he think this is making it easier to understand?
It's just so insane how complicated it is. I wonder when Sperling would come back.
Right now.
There you are. It's just so insane how complicated it is. It just makes me laugh. Nothing could make me not want to watch this show more than a description of the things we've learned in the first two episodes.
Well, the funny thing is I'm sitting there waiting for 60 seconds, counting to myself and realizing that I have to edit this show. So, of course, I'll probably have to hear it. Anyway.
You can edit out the whole thing. I feel terrible. Are you having fun? We haven't watched them yet.
I haven't watched them yet. But I'll tell you, if I had an iPad and could watch them on my iPad, I would actually probably be all caught up by now.
But could you? Could you watch it on an iPad? Does ABC.com use Flash, or what do they use?
They're part of Hulu.
Well, you
couldn't watch it.
Download it from iTunes.
That's right. You could pay for it, but you're allowed to watch it for free via Hulu. This is my big iPad thing. Now, I read an interesting article that said, you know what? Apple's just holding tight, and they're waiting for Hulu to fold and to start making it available via the Apple standard as well as Flash.
I read that same article, and I think there's probably a lot of truth to that.
Well, it's not that they're waiting for them to crack. Adobe has this proprietary technology called Flash, which is how most streaming video is served online. And HTML5 doesn't require Flash. So that's what everybody is moving to as a standard. And Apple is really trying to force the issue.
But why is Apple being so bitchy? Why don't they support Flash as well?
Because it doesn't behoove them to do so if people can get their content from iTunes.
Yeah, and they say that it's a processor hog, which is true.
Yeah, but if Hulu adopts HTML5, then we'll still be able to see it for free. So that can't be the reason that they're trying to push people to iTunes.
I think they're also waiting for Hulu to start charging, which is sure to happen.
So what did you think of the story about Disney's CEO, Bob Iger?
Well, I think that, Bob Iger is really good friends with a guy named Steve Jobs, as a matter of fact, who happens to be on Disney's board and maybe one of Disney's biggest shareholders.
I think he is the biggest shareholder.
Yeah, I mean, so the fact that Bob Iger's coming out and going, "Ooh, this is a game-changing technology.
This is a really compelling device."
Yeah.
Okay.
What, could he not see his iPhone? Is that, it was just too small for him to see? Because it's the same thing as the iPhone or the iPod Touch, just bigger. So it's the same technology.
But what I thought was interesting too, though, is that he starts talking about how it's going to change the way that TV shows and movies are distributed, and it's going to enable us to really start distributing product that is different than the product you typically see. And kind of talked in all these kind of... I felt like he didn't say anything specific, but he talked about how cool it's going to be.
Well, that's because there's not much specific to talk about.
But, the more I think about the iPad, the less keen I am on it, frankly. I would love to be handed one for free, but it doesn't replace my phone, so if I have to lug it around, it's just the whole beauty of the iPhone is that I don't need to carry a date book and an iPod and a phone.
And a computer sometimes.
Well, and even a computer to get my email, yeah.
But what's interesting is I was watching Modern Family, which is this ABC show.
And that Karen loves.
Yeah, we've heard of its brilliance.
Yeah, okay, well, and the father in the show is trying to explain to his daughter how to use this really complicated remote control for the television.
Oh my God, I love that episode.
And she turns him and says, "Why do I have to learn this? I watch TV on my computer." And I thought, how very telling. That is so true that there is this generation of 25 and younger that really just watches television on their computer.
Yeah, or their iPad.
So to them, the iPad is a big whoop.
No, it's a big deal, right? Because they can watch it on their iPad.
Oh, right. Oh,
or it's a big whoop because they're already watching it on their laptop. Yeah, I mean...
Well, I can tell you just how important some of these new smartphones and portable devices are. Over the weekend, I found somebody's iPhone at the mall just lying on a seat. And I actually spent some time trying to find the person who it belonged to. And when I finally found this person, she was so grateful. All of the pictures of her children were on that iPhone. I mean, it was like I was giving her a kidney. How did I find her? Her Facebook was on there, and her husband kept calling. So either I raised my voice up a couple of octaves or said, "Hey, I got your wife's phone."
Well, that was a big deal. Good for you. Good for you to do your Boy Scout deal of the week.
Well, I guess that means we're going to be moving into our popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the week's top entertainment news stories and decide whether they are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. Our first story this week is about Barbara Walters, who does a yearly Oscar special. This year will mark the last year she does that special. Her guests will be Sandra Bullock and Monique. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
This is a big deal. I watched the Barbara Walters special. Actually, it's a big deal for her career. She's known for doing this. Michael?
Yeah, I agree. It's a big deal. It's the end of an era. It's her winding down one of the more storied careers in television journalism. And Oprah is ready in the wings to take over. But she'll continue doing her 10 Most Fascinating People specials. But this really is her winding down and easing off into the sunset.
Actually, Sperling, I want to know, is Barbara Walters' Oscar special being her last a big deal to you?
Yes, it is. It's a big deal. Although, frankly, I never watch it anymore because it on the West Coast, it's after the Oscars, and I'm usually working.
Yeah, and it gets really pretty late at that point. I just usually will TiVo it and watch it the next day.
That's probably a smart idea.
Speaking of smart ideas, is this a smart idea? The Funny or Die guys are, their site, Funny or Die, is now going to have 30 minutes on HBO. So they're essentially, their site is going to be a show on HBO.
So that's Will Ferrell, Adam McKay, Chris Henchy, and Andrew Steele.
Right. Big deal, big whoop.
I'd have to see it first. It's a big whoop until I see it.
I have to say a big whoop because I've never been to their site, Funny or Die.
Well, that's part of the problem.
I think this is a big deal because sort of like Quarter Life, it's, you know, when a popular site or online show travels over into a different medium, I always think is sort of a big deal until we find the one that works. But it's probably going to end up being a big whoop because my guess is it'll fail.
Well, you know, HBO is smart to pick those guys up and throw it against the wall and see if it works. And they're also smart to make a deal with the hottest director in Hollywood. That's Kathryn Bigelow. HBO has snagged her among a series of deals that she's got going on. She has signed up with HBO to direct the pilot of a TV series written by Josh Logan. Is that his name? Josh Logan?
John Logan. John Logan.
I beg your pardon. He worked on the HBO telefilm RKO 281 about Orson Welles. He also got Oscar nominations for The Aviator and Gladiator. And he's written a pilot for a TV show called The Miraculous Year about a New York family seen through the eyes of their charismatic, self-destructive Broadway composer son. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
I'm torn. I'm one of the few people who believes that some of the best stuff is on TV. So in which case I would say big whoop. So she directs a pilot for TV.
Well, I would say that Kathryn Bigelow, who is a good director, directing work by John Logan, who I worked with at CAA and watched his career rise from RKO 281, which he wrote for HBO, and I believe Scott Free, the Ridley Scott, Tony Scott company, he's a phenomenal writer. And I think that the two of them together, they can actually create something quite good.
Well, in which case that would be a big deal. But if we're trying to say, is it a big deal that she's directing a pilot for TV, I'm going to say no.
I agree with you completely. There's no back and forth is so common. That's not the reason. It's a big deal. HBO got her, maybe. It's a big deal for them more than Kathryn Bigelow.
Yeah,
but I think it's a big whoop because she seems a terrible match for the material. Kathryn Bigelow's entire career has been founded on like action flicks and tough, fun, propulsive stuff. And a Broadway composer seems completely antithetical to everything she's ever done.
And it's probably why she's doing it in a different medium than the one that she's known for.
Well, our next topic is about 24, the television show, which is actually headed for the big screen. This season appears to be its last, and Variety is saying that they're going to make a movie out of the series. Is that a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. If they had shut the show down 3 years ago after season 6 or 7, it would have been a big deal. Take a year and a half off, let it rest, and then launch a big screen, you know, adventure whenever it was still high on the show. But they sort of waited till the show was worn down to the end. And now it's sort of like, yeah, and they're going to try and launch a movie. It seems like they waited too late. They should have shut the show down 3 years ago. So I say it's a big whoop.
Yeah, I agree. Big whoop. Does anybody care about 24 anymore?
Meanwhile on television, USA Network is taking some of its Friday hits and moving them to Wednesday and Thursdays. Ratings have begun to slide. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I posted this one because I think it's a big deal because for some reason TV channels refuse to put shows on Friday and Saturday. They've abandoned two nights of the week. They've got this valuable real estate where TV had some of their biggest hits of all time, like Dallas, Miami Vice, The Golden Girls, The Love Boat, Fantasy Island. And they refuse to show shows on those nights. They finally get hits on Friday night. USA Network wisely says, hey, let's put shows on Friday when the regular networks are turning off the lights and they have hits. And then they move them to Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. And guess what? They're now competing against all the other networks and it's not working well. It's just dumb on every level.
What shows did they move?
So two of the shows they moved were White Collar and Psych. And they also, I think they messed with Burn Notice as well. And it's just a ridiculously bad idea. Go where the other networks aren't. You know, program in the summer when they're showing reruns. Go to Friday and Saturday when the other networks are you know, turning off the lights. That's smart programming. So to take them and move them out of Friday and Saturday, Friday night where they've established themselves, is just incredibly bad network programming.
Our next story is a little close to home. Popular indie rock group MGMT.
Yay!
It's like The Simpsons. They are going to be releasing an album April 13th called Congratulations. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a huge, huge deal.
It's a huge deal. The band with two songs on the list of the 500 best of the noughts and their album on the best of the noughts the entire decade. Finally having their second album. It's very exciting. By the way, Spone, do we have the rights to use the snippet of their song that we use, or do we just use such a short amount we feel like it's okay and we always you know, tag them and give them credit and send people to their website. And we're hoping they just don't notice.
I'm sorry, you broke up there.
okay, that answers.
I don't know
question.
What you were saying, but you know, I look forward to seeing them at Coachella, and also heard that they were writing a musical or an opera. Believe it or not.
Cool.
Very cool.
Our final story is about Christopher Nolan, the filmmaker behind Batman Returns and Batman Forever, or The Dark Knight, as well as Memento, one of my favorite films. He has been asked to oversee the reboot of Superman. He would not direct it. It would not be a sequel to Superman Returns, which I guess was released in 2004, 2005, somewhere in that time frame, and completely flopped. Bryan Singer directed that, but he would oversee production. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
It's a big deal. It's a smart move, I think, on the behalf of the studio.
I think it's a big whoop because if he's not going to be in charge of it, why is he overseeing it? You know, what director of note is going to want to tackle the franchise if it's Christopher Nolan's baby? I think it's just a sign of how desperate they are and how confused they are about what to do about Superman.
That's why I think it's a big deal.
In a negative sense.
Yeah, I'm clinging to the desperation of the studio. I think it's awesome.
Yes. And I have one final big deal, big whoop. Can I throw it in, Sperling?
Yeah, I've got a final one too. Okay, go.
Oh,
wow.
Okay. Awesome. My final big deal, big whoop is a reminder that the box office for 2009, which just concluded, was a record $10.5 billion. In comparison, back in 1980, when movie budgets were a lot lower, the total box office, and this is U.S. only, was $2.7 billion. So the box office is four times as big in North America alone. It's dramatically bigger overseas. You had no cable, no DVD, no blah, blah, blah. So guess what? Movie budgets are going to cost more because they're making a lot more money. So everybody wants more of their pie. So there you go. Is that a big deal or big whoop, Karen?
You know, as soon as we talk about numbers, I start falling asleep. I don't know. I whatever you say, I'm going to agree with.
Sperling, what do you think?
Well, of course, it's a big deal. I heard it was 10.6, but $10.5 billion. It's the largest North American.
$10.59 billion. Yeah, it's rounding up to 10.6.
Well, I don't know. I mean, is it 10.5 or 10.6, you guys? It's a pretty big deal.
What's $100 million? It would be a big deal if it was my $100 million.
Okay, here's my big deal, big whoop, which is like the biggest deal, the biggest whoop in all of the tech blogs. Owen Van Atta from MySpace, MySpace CEO, being fired.
Talk to me. What does it mean?
It means MySpace is going down the toilet even faster than we had assumed.
Yeah, it means MySpace is the bloody Titanic.
Yeah, you don't want to be on it.
I just, you know what it is? I think that it's because I get such joy out of other people's failures.
You know, there's a word for that. It's called Schadenfreude.
Yeah. Schadenfreude, yeah. And I will cop to that. But that to me, this is gigantic, gigantic deal. And it's probably not, I guess, entertainment-based per se. But for somebody who combs the tech blogs like me, it's a gigantic deal.
I agree. It's a big deal.
Well, it's a big deal because MySpace could have been what iTunes is today. I mean, they have all of these bands putting all of this music up, and they really could have made something out of that. But instead, they let their technology and their site grow stagnant, and they didn't really know how to capitalize on that. They let Facebook come in and trounce all over them. iTunes came in and really became the music store that MySpace could have been. And so now they're a distant third or fourth in people's minds. And
they're a joke. People laugh about them. They're a punchline.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for them to come back. I mean, nobody's really ever come back in the tech world. Look at AOL. Look at Yahoo.
What's so interesting, because now the guy who's the head of digital over there at MySpace came from AOL. What are you thinking? And Ada, who came from Facebook. And from what I understand, those two guys were fighting with each other. And Ada is the guy who goes down. He seems to me he should have been the one that kept. Clearly, I feel very strongly about this. Okay, let's move on.
Well, if we're going to move on, then we're moving on to Inside Baseball, our segment where we talk about the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And in this case, this week, actually, nobody really cared about it. I asked several people to join us on today's podcast to discuss it, including the subject who has decided he really doesn't want to say any more, and that is Paul Fisher, who is an entertainment journalist an Australian entertainment journalist who lived here in Los Angeles. Full disclosure, I do know him and have worked with him in the past, at least beside him at junkets. He is, as Chris Perry of the Vancouver Sun said, a widely quoted film critic, has supplied moving marketing executives with favorable quotes for big studio movies for years. And it seems as if Chris Perry of the Vancouver Sun has a little axe to grind with Mr. Fisher. Mr. Fisher didn't do himself any justice here or any favors here by doing what he did, and that is he cribbed some of the the press notes, or not even press notes, the film guide for...
Cribbed. By cribbed, you mean stole?
Yes. He took the synopsis...
Blatantly plagiarized?
Yes, he plagiarized the Sundance film guide for some of the reviews he was writing, festival reviews, for Dark Horizons, an online outlet out of Australia. And his reviews have been taken down off of Dark Horizons, and he has announced his retirement from, I guess, junket journalism and entertainment journalism.
Well, good, he should.
What really was interesting to me about this was just how many people came out of the woodwork, most of them online, most of them bloggers, most of them kind of, it was like a shark tank. And not just kind of going after Paul Fisher, but then going after people commenting on the story about Paul Fisher.
I was surprised by how many people in the comment section were defending the guy, frankly. I was surprised by people who said things like, well, you know, that's what the press material is for, which is not true at all. It was, you know, they were saying, oh, you have it in for him. Oh, this is, you know, he has a lot of, it was really hard. You have a lot of movies to cover. And so you sort of grab material where you can, which is not true. You know, you can't pass off your own writing. You can't steal other people's writing and claim it as your own.
Perry writes here in an update to his post, which got a lot of press and a lot of play a week or so ago. He says, I have received a few emails from Fisher pals asking, are you happy now? Frankly, on a personal level, I would have preferred Fisher to admit what he did, explain his actions, and promise to correct them rather than fall on his sword. I've had to deal with cases of plagiarism at a few outlets that I've run previously, and on each occasion, that course of action was the end result. The offenders in both cases managed to rehab their reputations and do some great work after the fact. That option remains open to Fisher.
I think that what Sperling's trying to get at here is that this particular writer of this article, what was his name?
Chris Perry.
That he cares so much about this one particular writer. That he just, does he have it out for him for a good reason? Yeah, I mean, what the guy did was wrong. But it's the fact that he seems to care so much about.
But you know, you saw you quotes from the editors from some of these outlets he wrote for. And he's like, yeah, I've heard lots of complaints about him in the past. And other people said we've complained about him to our editors before and they did nothing about it. And that would be infuriating. It's like they knew what he was doing. They knew he was a hack. They knew he was stealing material. They knew he was not a real journalist. And yet they used him because he offered up his material for free.
Yeah, well, that's
so
a
then
problem.
They rather defensively say, well, where's your proof, when it's pointed out to them yet again? And finally it reached a big enough outlet that they finally had to do something about it. It's like, well, you know, if he's a thief robbing banks, yeah, you're going to keep pointing it out until somebody says, don't rob banks anymore. And I don't think the guy needs to wear a Scarlet A and be in the stocks, but why should he rehabilitate himself? He shouldn't work as a journalist ever again. So no, I do not think he should rehabilitate himself and get back to work in the industry and do some good work. He's clearly never done good work. He's a hack and a thief and a plagiarist, and he can get on with his life doing things other than trying to pretend to be a journalist when he's not one.
So how do you really feel?
Well, I don't understand. I don't understand Doris Kearns Goodwin goes on Jon Stewart all the time. She ripped off plagiarized material repeatedly, and everybody's too embarrassed to say something about it.
No, she got busted for that.
Well, what I found interesting about the story is that online, in the comments and in their blog posts, everybody was, they were like pit vipers going after one another. And not just Paul Fisher, they were going after each other. I mean, there are so many of these film bloggers and entertainment bloggers and movie critics now. Anybody with a pen is a movie critic. And so, you know, the second they smelled blood in the water, they all went after one another online. But then when I asked people to come and join us here to have an intelligent educational conversation about it, I pretty much got shut down by a lot of people. And I have to say, Eric Childress and David Poland were just not available. They did agree to come on, and the timing did not work out. Eric Childress is with eFilm Critic and Critic Watch, where he kind of makes chasing down quote whores a hobby. And David Poland is, of course, with Movie City News and The Hot Blog. And they couldn't be here to talk about it, but nobody actually wanted to have their actual voice heard.
Well, people are cowards sometimes. You know, they like to snipe online anonymously, but they don't want to do it in public. Or they think like it's the code of silence, the blue code of silence in the cops where, oh, you shouldn't blast this guy because you've sat next to him at a junket when he's proven himself to be a sham.
Is he really a journalist? Was he ever a journalist?
No.
Well, then there you go. Holding him to a standard that doesn't exist. He's not a journalist. Never was. Anyway, I think we're finished here.
Well, yeah, I think we're done. You know, it was very difficult to find somebody, so I'm sorry we weren't able to have a guest on to talk about it, or even Mr. Fisher on to talk about it. Although, after he hears Michael's opinion, he might, you know, run.
Definitely not going to come on.
Exactly.
I would happily listen to what he had to say. Maybe he has some, I can't imagine what the reason would be for robbing the bank, but I'd be happy to hear him out and try to be as polite as possible. It doesn't mean I'm going to give him a free pass, but.
Okay, well, on that note, I guess that's the end of Mr. Fisher's career in journalism, at least for now. It's also the end of our podcast. Another programming note, we had one at the beginning, we'll have one at the end. There will not be a podcast next week. Again, please go to iTunes or Zune Marketplace or any podcast reader and subscribe to our podcast. You can find links to ways to subscribe or our RSS feed on our website, which is at showbizsandbox.com. You can also find the show notes for episode 42 there, links to all of the stories we discussed, showbizsandbox.com. If you want to email us, you can find the information on our website. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. If you want to leave us a voicemail, the number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Our website is where you'll also find links to all of our social network accounts, including Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, you name it, YouTube. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our episodes is by the popular rock group with an album coming out on April 13th, MGMT. Their music can be found on MySpace, remarkably, myspace.com/MGMT, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found, well, at least his work can, at michaelgiltz.com. He's also on Twitter. The username to look up is at Michael Giltz. Karen Woodward is on Twitter. The username to look up is Karen_Woodward, and her work can be found on her website, karenwoodwardonline.com. My work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com, at least some of it. I can also be found on Twitter. At Sperling is the username to look up. I highly suggest you follow our Twitter account, at showbizsandbox. And not until next week, until 2 weeks from now, play nice. Ba-ba-ba-ba-da.